Welcome to the first episode of the Cowboys on the Commons podcast. I'm Matt. I'm a member of Solidarity House Cooperative, a worker-owned production company. The Cowboys on the Commons podcast intends to follow the same themes as my blog, cowboysonthecommons.org. That's cooperative economics, cooperation and law and public policy, cooperation and culture. We also want to talk about the places where humans are not cooperating, where hierarchies and non-sustainable power arrangements are creating suffering and damage, and how we might replace the toxic and unjust systems that we see now with cooperative, sustainable systems. We're producing this series as part of our overall effort at Solidarity House Cooperative to publicize, celebrate, and deliberate about the many ways people are working everywhere to create a better material and accompanying legal, political, and cultural world. If you know people who are doing this work, we'd love to hear about it. Connect with us on Facebook or Twitter, follow us on Podbean, and of course, listen to and support us on Patreon. We're Solidarity House Cooperative. Our first episode doesn't seem to have a lot to do with cowboys, except in the very metaphorical sense that it's about hardworking people. But it does have a lot to do with fighting for the commons. It's about the city of Chicago, a place with a long and valued and at times bloody history of labor, including anarchist and socialist struggles, big bosses in business and government, and lots of everyday heroes. When Rahm Emanuel announced last month that he would not seek a third term as mayor of Chicago, he broke no hearts among people opposed to neoliberal privatization and the power of finance capital. In Chicago under Mayor Emanuel, as the editors of the 2016 anthology Neoliberal Chicago wrote, neoliberalism led officials to privatize everything from parking meters to schools, to gut regulations and social services, and to promote gentrification wherever possible. But I've run into countless Chicagoans over the years who have a very different vision of that city than Rahm and his predecessor, Mayor Richard M. Daley, had. I've interviewed and collaborated with people like Barry Corin, the Time Exchange activist, Debbie Hillman, co-founder of the Evanston Food Policy Council, and Amara Enya, the community organizer with the chops for cooperative economics, who's making her second run for mayor with an agenda that could be described as facilitate a paradigm shift away from Rahm Emanuel and neoliberalism. In August, Chicago held a cooperative economics summit, and the Illinois Worker Cooperative Alliance, in partnership with the Business Enterprise Law Clinic and the John Marshall Law School, released Cooperation Chicago in August, a report dealing with the challenges and opportunities of worker cooperatives in the Chicagoland region. I wanted to know all about what was happening in one of my favorite big cities, so I reached out to Amara Enya, who I've had a chance to hang out with a little earlier this year at a meeting of public banking activists in Colorado.
The last time I saw you was at a summit for public banking advocates. So what is, you know, Chicago-based organizer, activist, mayoral candidate doing at that meeting? Why was it important for you even to be there for the time that you were there?
Absolutely important for me to be there because this work to me represents years of organizing and work that's been happening on the ground across the country, but also right here in Illinois, and work that I had been doing as well. And so it's just important to connect with other people who are at the front lines of trying to push this as an agenda item across the country. Part of it is for me was just knowing that there are people elsewhere who are in the same fight and who are, you know, just as passionate about how this could be transformative. And then the other was to get a sense of how this is moving in other places outside of Chicago, outside of Illinois, just to kind of see what the national landscape is. And then the third piece that I was hoping to accomplish there was really to present some of the things that I've learned doing this work and hopefully that could be helpful as people are engaged in this work in different states and cities across the country.
Public banking has always been part of a larger picture for you, which is the difference between a privatized Chicago and a privatized Illinois versus a Chicago and Illinois that honors kind of a public commons and the idea of community resources and public resources.
It really is about what it means to have a public commons, to believe in the public space. Because I think we're living in a time where the trend is about privatizing. And so, and this has been happening quite frankly for years, where there's this notion of devaluing the public and sort of placing more value on the private sector. And what has happened is we've seen this whole scale shift, both of wealth from the public and of resources from the public into private hands. And in no other place is that more evident than when you talk about the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a massive transfer of wealth happening from the public, taxpayers, residents, people who live in our cities and in our states, going into private hands. And so that is why the idea of a public bank is so absolutely powerful, because it strikes at the very heart of where that mass transfer is taking place. The other thing is about allegiance to the public and this notion of the public good. I think what we're discovering now, those who have been sort of at the forefront of privatization, are finding that you simply cannot have a public good that is as great and as wonderful as it can be if it is privatized, because the allegiance of private actors is always to profit. It is always to profit. And that is, to me, diametrically opposed to what is in the interest of the public, which is always about how do we make sure that this is the public, people can benefit from whatever the good or the service is. And so if you have that conflict, it, to me, you cannot reconcile allegiance to profit with allegiance to public good. And we've seen that happen where in Chicago, for example, we privatized janitorial services for our schools in Chicago Public Schools. Last year and this year, we found that there were students who were learning, who were in schools where there were rats and mice and rodents running around in classrooms, where there were filthy conditions to the point at which some of these schools had to be closed and cleaned. This is what happens when you privatize services. And it was happening across the city. We also are privatizing, you know, this notion of privatizing education with the proliferation of charter schools, where it was seen as if we privatize education and create competition, you know, these market-driven theories, that somehow all schools will then compete with each other and they will all be better off. Well, what we're seeing happened is the proliferation of charter schools, in some instances, it was a building boom of these new schools, sometimes locating right next to public neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. And because in Chicago Public Schools, they have a student-based budgeting model, which means the funding follows the students, these schools were now competing for students. And so in the same neighborhood, they were competing for a limited pool of students, and it came down to whoever had the better marketing budget would get the students. And of course, the charter schools would have the better marketing budget. But what we're finding is that they did not necessarily have better outcomes, better academic outcomes for students. And in fact, we found that the disciplinary issues within charter schools were egregious, suspending students at times 2,500 times what the average student would have in a regular public neighborhood school. We found now that this was not the panacea. But what happened is, all of the money that was spent on building these new charter schools and public neighborhood schools was harmful. Not only that, as the population of students in CPS declined, as the city's population declined, now you have fewer students, which means the competition was even more intense. And it's essentially this cannibalization of schools, which is the current landscape that we have in education. Mm-hmm. Look at our public assets. Chicago is notorious for privatizing its public assets. And the problem with that, the reason why it's so frightening, is because we export our policy around the country. So when Mayor Daley privatized the parking meters, essentially selling off our parking meters, which is a public asset, for $1 billion to a private company for these long generational, multi-generational leases, we essentially gave away our public asset and we cannot benefit from revenues from that public asset. It's one of the worst deals that, in my view, in municipal government in history. And other municipalities started to see this trend and they started privatizing all of their public assets. Well, what we're finding is we gave all of our assets to the private sector. We're not able to generate the revenue that cities so desperately need, because once you sell them off to private actors, they reap all of the profits. And again, because their allegiance is to the profit, to making a profit, not to the public. And so what happens for us is parking becomes extremely expensive, prohibitively expensive, but the services aren't necessarily improving. And now the city also doesn't get any of that revenue. We attempted to privatize our skyway. So privatization has not created the windfall of revenue that cities need. But now, because of these multi-generational leases, 75 years, 99 years, cities are essentially giving away future revenue from the public assets that they now no longer have. So this is a huge problem. And most of these cities are still broke and still scrambling, trying to figure out how they're going to meet day-to-day operational expenses. And so at the same time, there's a narrative that has attempted to devalue the notion of public goods and public services. Look at what happens in our schools, demonizing teachers and public school teachers, that somehow they don't deserve to be paid individual and family-sustaining salaries, demonizing public sector workers, blaming public sector workers for our pension problems, which that was actually, those are problems that were created by corrupt leadership that refused to pay into the pensions at the rates that they were supposed to. And now, instead of recognizing that, we instead will try to demonize and devalue public sector workers.
Part of this big picture that you're talking about is part of a decades-long offensive by these corporate and financial forces. Rahm Emanuel has kind of bought into that paradigm, or has really bought into that paradigm, and kind of also evidence of how this is kind of a bipartisan problem, right? You have, you know, particularly mayors and state officials around the country from both parties really buying into this notion that you can have public-private partnerships, or that you can allow Wall Street to use your public funds and, you know, try to get you these amazing deals that never come through. You know, it's not a Republican versus Democrat thing.
Right. Right. It's certainly not a Republican versus Democrat thing. It is, you know, largely part of this neoliberal philosophy that I think is predominant definitely here in Chicago. And just an overarching philosophy that really transcends Republican or Democrat, because there are people who adopt this philosophy on either side. And it is one that devalues the public, that prioritizes the private sector, that wants to privatize and sell off public assets, and that does not believe in the notion of a public good.
Rahm Emanuel has been, you know, has at times seemed just contemptuous of the public sector, very combative about these questions, and it kind of blows me away, because when you're a mayor of an urban city, just it sort of astounds me how you can have that worldview when most of these issues are so much more obvious in an urban context. And so I'm kind of amazed at that, you know, at his intransigence, and which I'm sure that Chicagoans can talk a lot more about than I can.
Well, if you look at other cities like New York, if you look at Philadelphia, if you look at what happened in New Orleans after Katrina, where they used a disaster to essentially privatize the entire educational system.
Right.
So I feel like the trend really took hold, and it's still too early to tell what other cities are doing to combat that. Now, I look at some examples of some innovative things that are happening, for example, in Oakland, California, around the legalization of marijuana, and making sure that there's an equity component that ensures that those who have been harmed by being arrested as part of the prison pipeline, in my view, that mm-hmm. there's some equity where they can actually participate in the economy in some very tangible ways. I see that as a kind of granular level policy making that actually can undo some of the harm that were caused by this shift to privatization and moving away from the public sector. It's harder because at the national level, for example, you've got Betsy DeVos, who is the poster child for charter schools and the poster child for privatization, who has not a clue of anything about education policy, and yet is driving the policy agenda for the entire country. Mm-hmm. So what do school districts do in the face of that, right? So I think that there's still this, we're still embedded in the mess caused by the shift to privatization.
What are some day one, week one things that you want to do as mayor, policy-wise, you know, really specifically, to try to reverse that trend and try to reclaim the urban commons?
Well, there are a few things that we can do in Chicago. So I've been working on this issue of the public bank for several years now. And so it is one of the first things that I would start to set in motion is actually establishing a public bank in the city of Chicago. We can definitely do that on day one, and I have every intention of doing that on day one, because I think that it is absolutely essential for the city's fiscal health. Also, when we talk about infrastructure, I mean, Chicago is a major infrastructure town. Our roads, bridges, waterways, for infrastructure projects, because we are actually paying 40% to 50% just in interest on those projects to private actors. The other reason why the public bank is so absolutely essential is because for years, Chicago has been paying hundreds of millions of dollars just in fees to private banks, our current private banks. And this is because those same private banks negotiated bad bank deals called toxic swaps. Essentially gambling whether or not we would have favorable interest rates. And when we don't, it triggers a fine. It triggers a payment that we now have to make. And in some instances, it was several hundred millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So when we think about not having enough money to operate as a city, we have to look at, well, where are the areas where we are essentially wasting money? And that is in these bad bank deals. It is in the cost overruns for our large-scale infrastructure projects. It's the fact that we cannot issue the low-interest loans for entrepreneurs who want to start up businesses, which greatly helps our local economy. These are the things that a public bank would absolutely be able to positively affect. And so it's why it's one of the first things that I would do. The other thing that's big for me is really diversifying the economic ecosystem by expanding cooperative economic models across the board. And I want Chicago to be the number one city in the country for that. There's no reason why we shouldn't be. The traditional business models and the traditional economic models have reached the plateau, in my view. This means that we have to diversify the economic ecosystem with models that actually build individual and community wealth. And so for me, that means pathways to ownership, so worker-owned cooperatives as the alternative to your traditional business. It means that we're able to create ownership, especially in challenged communities. There's a notion of being vested in the community when you own the businesses in the community and when you own them collectively. And again, it's an opportunity to build wealth. Also, housing cooperatives. We mm-hmm. have an issue of affordability in Chicago, with people not being able to afford their housing. So housing cooperatives are one way of creating affordability so that people are not getting pushed out or displaced out of their communities, especially as they gentrify. The other piece to me is, you know, I did a lot of urban planning work, and the first question in urban planning is who owns the land? And if we're talking about the ability for people to stay in their communities and make sure that communities are affordable, it's about land ownership. And so community land trusts, to me, are absolutely important to creating the kind of city that is inclusive and that can thrive. Community land banks. These are the kinds of things that are not and should not be just niche ideas. Mm-hmm. To me, they are the core of a new economy that is inclusive and that ensures that the entire city can grow and thrive, not just large corporations or those who are politically connected or extremely wealthy. So that's another thing that I would do. The third thing that I would do is really creating an entire agenda around the preservation of our water as a public good and being intentional about that. We have the privilege of being right on Lake Michigan. It's one of the largest freshwater sources in the world, and water is absolutely essential to the future. And I think we have to be proactive about making sure that we establish our waterways and our access to the lake as a public good. And also around creating jobs through clean energy and using that as a mechanism to create jobs in the city, as well as making the city much more sustainable, being at the forefront of clean energy as a mechanism to sustain the city. That's another priority that I would have. There are a lot of things that we can do that don't take 10 years to do, that if we just had the will and the imagination and the vision to do them, we can actually do them. So I definitely want to direct people to the website where they can learn more information. It's amaraenya.com. That's AmaraEnya.com. And there they can learn more about the platform, the issues. We've got videos and other information and media on there. Also on all of the social media platforms, we are there. So everything is AmaraEnya on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. They can follow to get more information about the campaign. I think it's important to note that we see this campaign as national, because Chicago has been sort of the epicenter of politics. We export our politics and we export our policies for good or bad across the country. And so we really want to encourage people, even outside of Chicago, to get involved in this campaign in any way that they can, because it really is about a paradigm shift in leadership and a paradigm shift in government that can start at the epicenter of politics and policy in this country.
So there's a longer version of this interview available to our subscribers on Patreon. Amara talks about perceptions of crime and violence in Chicago and how that too is tied into privatization, into the collapse of public spaces and resources and the lie that there is not enough money. The alienation of people in cities like Chicago is partly related to this Rahm Emanuel-style neoliberal capitalism that she and others in Chicago are anxious to reverse. Amara Enya is an energetic, charismatic, in a good way, political candidate. Getting a person like Amara into office would be a huge win for cooperative economics. She knows cooperation, she can speak and explain it in ways that ring true to people, and she's committed to grassroots empowerment, actual empowerment. But for cooperative economics to grow in a place like Chicago, you also need hundreds of entities acting enthusiastically, systemically, energetically, with as much coordination as possible. You need cooperative businesses and policymaking bodies acting together. That means changing city and county procurement policies. It means codifying cooperation. So I got to meet and talk to Mike Strode about this. Who's Mike Strode? He's a technical advisor and organizer and networking expert for cooperatives in Chicago and outside of it. He's worked for the Black Oak Center for Sustainable Renewable Living in a black farming township called Pembroke, and for the Healthy Food Hub in Chicago. And he's the exchange coordinator at Kola Nut Collaborative. The collaborative's mission is to make social infrastructure more visible within communities.
And so my work with them with the Healthy Food Hub was an attempt to establish a pipeline that was community controlled, that had production hubs, aggregation hubs, and distribution hubs. Part of my work with the Cold Nut Collaborative grows out of the desire to have communities themselves adopt the distribution points and be in the space of owning that distribution point. And the Cold Nut Collaborative and Time Banking was a way to incentivize communities to own those distribution points. We haven't perfected that system yet, but the model is still in play. And so we are anxious to kind of get people to understand that as a model for how communities could have local food access year-round and have a connection with farming communities. I would say that it's emergent. You know, that's certainly the phrase of the day, a la Adrienne Marie Brown, an emergent strategy. The work of cooperation in Chicago is very emergent. And that means that you have lots of different people doing lots of different things in sort of silos. And one of the opportunities that arose as we recently held the Cooperative Economy Summit back on August 25th was to get everybody into the room and, you know, to get them in conversation with each other, to get them talking about the work that they're doing and the work that they're excited about doing, and possibly even, you know, doing some projections on possible collaborations with other cooperators. And so that we did accomplish that work of getting people into a room and getting them engaged in sort of what was cross-sector cooperative work, because certainly there have been cooperative coalitions amongst food cooperatives. Certainly NASCO, the North American Students of Cooperation, is housed here. And so, you know, there's a lot of work around housing cooperatives in the city as well. But all of that work occurs in these sort of sectoral silos. So we were trying to get people to kind of think about this cooperative economy as a broad cross-section or cross-sectoral work and get, you know, the food cooperatives thinking about how to do deeper cooperation cooperation with the housing cooperatives to think about how those things might tie into time banking to get that to kind of be intersected or to intersect and connect with people who are doing participatory budgeting, to get people to think about how that works on the policy space.
That policy space is important. Law and policy codify and implement material changes. Law and policy are imperfect, but things happen through them. Many activists avoid thinking about this, and others maybe think about it too much. What legal changes would help cooperatives in Chicago?
I've drawn from the work of my colleague, Renee Hatcher, of the John Marshall Business Enterprise Law Clinic. She's director over there. And so she's, from a legal perspective, she often tells people when they get in a room with her, well, it's not the laws that are stopping people from cooperating here. you can certainly work with whatever laws you have and build something that works and build coalitions that will help people to get things to work. Now, what we have been trying to change, and certainly what the Illinois Worker Cooperatives Alliance and John Marshall Business Enterprise Law Clinic worked on, was a document called Cooperation Chicago. They were presenting that document to the Cook County Commission of Social Innovation here. If the county could adopt a resolution that would talk about the possibilities for worker cooperatives as an innovative social enterprise and as something that needs to be supported by county policy, then that would possibly change procurement rules on the county level, which would mean that, worker cooperatives could compete for, those endeavors, and we could kind of carve out a section of contracts where worker cooperatives compete. And so that allows for a little bit more of rapid capitalization if, they actually have work coming in and they have work they can compete for and work towards. That lends a little bit more for the sector to grow. Now, on the state level, we've got this Illinois Cooperative Act, and, there's recently been another paper that was produced by the UIC Great Cities Institute, authored by Alex Linares. And in that paper, they talk about things in the state statute that need to be changed. So the state statute really caters to agricultural cooperatives, and it's only recently that they've adopted, any language that states that any entity or any sector can be, considered a cooperative, but they still don't really rigorously define a worker cooperative in that statute or any sort of or talk about anything about as to how worker cooperatives could be constituted. And so in terms of those things, the importance of those policy changes and those statute changes would be that we have financial bodies, we have entities such as chambers of commerce and things like that here, that when they're helping people to set up businesses locally, they don't really have they are not aware, or they're just not interested in talking to cooperatives as an entity that could be started. And so therefore these sector and these entities don't really have visibility. And so changing the policy heightens the possibility that we get more visibility towards these entities and get more people interested in the possibility of developing them. And certainly from a perspective of helping marginalized communities in the city of Chicago to think about other ways that they can constitute themselves as a business that wouldn't necessarily be as lonesome as entrepreneurship, having that visibility to that sector and those entities would be very beneficial and, could rapidly kind of expand the growth of these community-owned institutions and community-owned enterprises.
Mike's colleague, Professor Renee Hatcher, is right. It's not the laws that are stopping cooperation, but new laws and new regulatory and administrative and other policy changes can help speed up that revolution. And true to the spirit of the endeavor, the exact nature of those policy demands is up to those willing to show up and participate in their discussion and construction.
I operate sort of administer the Solidarity Economies of Greater Chicago Facebook group, which, was essentially established so that people could start to do some of that collaboration and some of that communication with one another, because I was attempting to introduce the time bank to the city, and it was difficult to introduce a concept like that outside of this broader aspect of thinking about cooperation as something intentional that we do as an economic model, as a social model. So inside of that group, I've also been encouraging folks to kind of think through, let's make sure that we have a solidarity economy platform or a cooperative economy platform, make sure that we're endorsing the platform as opposed to endorsing the candidate. And so to the extent that, you know, I am seeking to have people endorse platforms, I want candidates near that office, in that office, inside of these city bodies, these municipal bodies. I want us to actually have a platform that speaks to these elements of the solidarity economy that would involve going to some of the communities that have had some of the local battles around environmental justice, and so therefore who understand what it looks like to develop a community benefits agreement around companies that want to settle in these communities, but that have really deep environmental impacts on these communities, and have the community be able to have a vote and have a say. So I want, you know, mayoral candidates who are really interested in making sure that all of the wards in Chicago are implementing participatory budgeting, and that, you know, there's a real strong push to deepen democracy at the local level, rather than, you know, right now with the mayoral office in Chicago, you know, not having things like a term limit, you know, and having all of these powers that accrue to the mayor. I'm interested in candidates who want to remove some of those mayoral powers, who want to just give some of that away. Like, how do we push that back into local bodies and then, you know, deepen democracy and deepen civic life at the local level, so that then we can have an upsurge in that civic energy that is able to do things on a broader city level, because we already have that power on the local level to make changes and to enforce policy and to develop in ways that really, really serve the priorities of local community. You know, because I've been able to talk with folks in St. Louis and out of Jackson and out of various other cities, it's the grass is always greener on the other side. So, you know, when I look at St. Louis and I look at a project like Solidarity Economy St. Louis, it seems like, oh, man, it's so great. You know, there's some solidarity happening there. I really wish, you know, we had, like, you know, at least a coalition that looked like that. But certainly there have been others who have talked to me and said, oh, there's so much great things happening in Chicago. And I'm like, well, you know, it's hard. And so everywhere, I think we are all trying to figure out how to both interlink the cooperative economies, but also make sure that we are decentralized enough so that it doesn't become the work of one cooperative body to shoulder all of that work and that weight.
You can read my new article at Occupy.com. After ROM's destruction, can Chicago create a cooperative economy? Is the name of the article. And it's a written treatment of these same discussions that we've had here on this episode. You can support this podcast and our work at Solidarity House Cooperative, including the building of an eco-village, by subscribing at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. You'll also get access to full-length interviews and much more. On upcoming episodes of Cowboys on the Commons, the necessity of coming to terms with climate change cooperatively. And we're going to have multiple episodes on immigration, refugees, and cooperative politics. That's all coming up.